I'm Jessica Harris, and welcome to my welcome table. I'm going to be that the welcome table. Gather round this special table. It's scarred with memories, pitted with burn spots from hot skillets, and decorated with moisture rings from frosty glasses of lemonade, beer bottles, bourbon and ginger ale, and untold goblets of red wine. This table will be our flying carpet as we travel around the world. I'll share some of my secret spots. We'll meet new friends and reconnect with old ones. Sometimes, the table will be covered with fine Porthot linen and my mother's bone china, and we'll sup on caviar and champagne. Other times, we'll cover it with yesterday's news and hanker down for a crawfish boil or a lobster supper. Whatever the meal, by the end of our time together, we'll have shared some special friends, sacred spots, and the food, drink, and music that connects them. So come, join me at my welcome table.
Hi, my name's Mitzi Pratt, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I am Patrick Dunn, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is John Barkley, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Anne McBride, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
I'm Betty Fussell, and I, too, am sitting at the welcome table.
Compass Point, 18.41 degrees south, 33.94 degrees east, Cape Town, South Africa. I'd avoided South Africa for years while I was editor of the Africa-South Africa section of Travel Weekly back in the 1980s. Then, apartheid was the rule of order. And even though the gentleman from the South African tourist office, impressed, no doubt, by my flawless French at our New York City luncheon, assured me that I would be unaffected by the passbook rules, I had no hesitation about saying no. Hell no. I was a bit more polite then, and a bit more diplomatic. It was therefore with great trepidation and memories of the bad old days that I boarded the South African Airways plane to head to Cape Town decades later. Mandela then was known as Madiba, and reconciliation was the word. I wasn't so sure. But by the time I'd been pampered, coddled, wined, and fed, often on the more than 14-hour flight from New York, I was a little more willing to be conciliatory. I wandered through Johannesburg Airport, noting only the Wild West, land of opportunity, aggression about the airport. But duels there were held with cell phones, mine is newer than yours, not six guns. I passed through customs and headed to the domestic flight to Cape Town, where they whined and fed me again. How come they can feed you a full meal on a brief flight, when in the U.S. you can barely get a packet of peanuts and a $7 bottle of bad wine? Then it was arrival. Dazed by the length of the flight and the time change, I went on autopilot and arrived at the hotel, Sellers in Hoornhout, to register, unpack. And then I decided to head down for dinner. When I arrived in the restaurant, I woke up. My Lord, it was gorgeous. The restaurant was incredible. Chairs in dark wood with letter lattice work, and a menu that was, and still is, one of the best I'd had on all of my travels. Now, it might have been the hour, and it might have been the jet lag, but the meal was incredible. Breaded, wonderful lamb chop, fresh, tender, served with a duxelle, and just a potato galette, oyster mushrooms, followed by a cheese plate, red Leicester with green sage, a hard cheese, a blue Stilton, camembert, and washed down with my first taste of a sumptuous wine that remains in my memory and unfortunately not in my cellar, which was a Groot Constantia. Anyhow, it was South Africa, a new world, a new place. Cape Town was a startling experience for me the next day. The sheer beauty of the region constantly surprised me, and it is at the top of my list, along with Rio de Janeiro and Hong Kong, for scenic magnificence. Ocean, water, mountains. The warmth of the greeting of the people that I met delighted me, and I was also thrilled by the food. Wherever I turned, there seemed to be someone talking about food, or eating, or planning to eat, or cooking, or selling something delicious. By the time morning dawned and I breakfasted on wonderful apricot preserves and crusty croissants, I knew that Cape Town was a city I could learn to love, an undiscovered culinary capital of my African Atlantic world. During the following days, I would meet some of the chefs who create the culinary diversity that is Cape Town. Over lunch, I would speak with Romola Parbu about the Indian cooking of South Africa and learn that Natal Province and its capital, Durban, are where to go for the best Indian food. It's from there that we find bunny chow. The main influences are Hindu, and the earliest wave of immigrants came in the late 19th century from southern India to work the sugarcane, much as they had in the Caribbean. In the 1920s through 1940s, there was a second wave of folks. They came from the Gujarat region, and so there are a variety of cuisines. Indian families there live authentically and traditionally within their own communities. One of the first books that a new bride receives is Indian Delights, an Indian cookbook for South African housewives that offers variations on all of the special dishes, as well as advice for the novices written in motherly tones. Romola has written several cookbooks, including tomes on vegetarianism and Ayurvedic food habits. Cass Abrams appealed to me right away because she'd begun her career as a teacher. Cass was born a Christian and is of German and Xhosa origin. She was born in Johannesburg, but when she married into the Cape Malay community in Cape Town and converted to Islam, she discovered that the key to acceptance lay not in religious and social conformity, but in a woman's command of her cooking pots. She told me, "Any woman worth her salt in that community can cook." So I quickly learned to cook. She also told me, "I was a bit of a rebel, a former Roman Catholic, and I couldn't cook. The community felt very sorry for my husband, and I went through hellfire and brimstone and learned to cook to justify my existence." Cass defined Cape Malay food as a harmonious mixture of Dutch food and slave spicing. But since those who were enslaved in South Africa came from various points, the spicing was diverse and distinct. Cape Malay food has so gained in popularity that today most major hotel restaurants serve it. The food was basically the food that was served on the Cape Flats until 1992 by people called Cape Malay. And with the rebirth of the tourist industry post-apartheid, this food came out of the closet. It's a cuisine that everyone is trying to define, so vast that Ahmad Marcus, the chef owner of Cape Manor Restaurant, put it, "Everybody's granny has a different recipe for a different dish." Now, Fadhila Williams is another of the Cape Malay culinary artists. She has done all sorts of incredible things and writes cookbooks that are beautifully illustrated and that also talk about this cuisine that is representative of the Cape. She was born and raised in a close-knit Muslim family, and her grandmother was a great cook. And it was at her side that Fadhila learned the secrets of this cooking. Now, through the years, she has done something slightly different and uses time-saving methods and appliances to make these dishes a little more accessible. But her cookbooks, as are Cass Abrams, are must-haves for anyone wanting to know a little bit more about the food of the Cape Malay. Now, the grand dame of Cape Malay food is Hildegonda Duckett. And it's interesting because she wasn't a Cape Malay. She was born in 1840 and wrote two cookbooks, but her work presents a vivid picture of her life in the Cape. Her biography can be found in Quadrilles and Confits, a wonderful book title that talks about the life and presents her journal. It was written by her grandniece. She describes her aunt, her great aunt, as South Africa's Mrs. Beaton. And the book that she wrote, Hilda's Where Is It?, is a collection of recipes that is amazing because it includes not only Cape Malay recipes, but Indian recipes and recipes from all over, this back at the turn of the 20th century. Okay. Small pause. The Dictionary of South African Biography describes Hilda's Where Is It? As the first attempts to compile a recipe book for South Africans and to include traditional recipes from all racial groups of the Cape. In the introduction, which is dated October 1890, the author says, "It was at the suggestion of some friends in England that I have collected some homely and old-fashioned recipes from friends, relations and friends and from practical housewives. The recipes are arranged alphabetically from anchovies on toast to zoet crackling, and many have descriptive subtitles such as In the Old Cape Way, a Dutch recipe, or simply a Cape dish." I learned about the food of the Cape Malay in the homes of some of the people I met during my Cape Town sojourn. At the home of Shireen Parker and her husband Faisal, I tasted sugar bean briedi, a Cape Malay cousin of France's cassoulet and South Carolina's hoppenjohn. But I also tasted a tomato briedi that had the sweet taste of caramelized tomatoes. Then there was a biryani prepared with snook, a fish that's very much prized. There are those who are not as fortunate as I am and probably won't meet Cass or Fadhila or even Shireen. But there are many restaurants in town that celebrate the food of the Cape Malay. Cape Manna on Napier Street is the perfect place to taste such specialties. There, I tried for the first time waterbloemensch, a seed pod from water lily-like plant that tastes like a cross between asparagus and artichokes. Confit, preserved fruit with a jam-like consistency that's eaten as dessert or candy and that can also be served on special occasions like weddings and christenings. Then there's also Denningfleisch, a stew prepared from cubed mutton that is marinated with turmeric, garlic, cloves, allspice, sesame, salt, pepper with a dash of vinegar and a pinch of sugar. I learned about rooibos tea, red bush tea, and also about henningbus. Rooibos has now taken over here as red bush tea. non-caffeine, but Henningbus is less well-known and is honeybush, sweet and wonderful. Now, the Cape Malay who produced this food are the Creoles of Cape Town, and they have a society that is complex and deeply layered as anything that New Orleans can boast of. While there was Malay in their mix of cultures, there was also a bit of West African, a bit of Khoi and San, the original South Africans, and a bit of other ethnicities known and unknown. Mainly Muslim, their culture is family-based, with large, close-knit family groups the norm. In the bad old days of apartheid, they lived mainly in the Cape Province, and in Cape Town, they lived mainly in District 6. District 6 was known for its vibrant culture, which included an annual carnival marked with music, dancing, and great food. District 6, though, was destroyed under apartheid. Under the guise of urban renewal, the bulldozers arrived on February 11, 1966, and the neighborhood that had been home to families for generations was razed to the ground. The families were dispersed, but the memories lingered. And they have phoenix-like given birth to the District 6 Museum, which celebrates the life of the former neighborhood in all its vibrancy. Street maps on the floor allow former residents to reclaim their homes and add their names and mementos. As such, the museum is a living, breathing place, one where former street signs recall Rutgers Street and Primrose Street and Balmoral Street, among others, and where the life of District 6 continues. Guguletu, Butchery, Superette, Best Meaty Place in Googs, reads Nozama Gertrude Cuba's business card. She's competent, capable, and an energetic black woman of the type that I've seen behind market stands in Jamaica and Brazil, at work in the fields in Senegal and Haiti, and in front of stoves and church suppers in the U.S. I'm speaking with her in her small office cubicle in the convenience store and meat market that she owns in the township of Guguletu, outside of Cape Town. Guguletu is my first look at life in South Africa for black South Africans and what it must have been like before Mandela was out. I was later to find out that the location of Guguletu was chosen with diabolical exactness. It's situated where it is strafed by winds that are alternately blisteringly hot in summer and frigid in winter. The views are bleak, and the folk are dressed in heavy sweaters and wool caps. But there are pockets of brightness, like the small yellow flowers growing on the side of the road and the front gardens, and the smiles of playing children. Although it is late summer in the northern hemisphere, in Cape Town, winter is yielding its grip to the softer weather of spring. We pass a shebeen, or beer bar, where people congregate for scattered moments of joy amidst what is still a harsh environment. The shebeens were outlawed under the old regime, and they are now the main gathering spots in the townships, rocking with beer and music until all hours. Other gathering spots include spaces like Nozamo's Butcher Shop, which offers special braais or South African barbecues on weekends and for special occasions. "You should come back then," she tells me. "There's music and dancing and laughter and lots of food." This, she says, while showing me the enormous barbecue grills that she's constructed, stacked with firewood, awaiting the next bash. I think of rearranging my schedule, but know all too well the time is already too short. Back in her office, we turn to the realities of life for women around the world and feeding a family. Nozamo is very aware of the price of maize. It was about 50 cents a kilo, but 10 people cannot eat off a kilo of maize. I confess to her my confusion about the use of the term maize and mealy, and she explains patiently that maize is dried corn. She brings out a small package of the precious commodity and gives it to me as a gift. It is similar to what my family has always called samp, or broken bits of dry white corn that has been processed. Mealy, on the other hand, is cornmeal. Both forms are in abundant use in South Africa. Corn is not only expensive to buy, it is expensive to prepare because it uses about 3 hours worth of fuel for cooking, but it is still a major staple. Nomzamo explains some of the most common dishes to me and their region and ethnic distinctions. Mealiepap is cornmeal porridge prepared for white or yellow cornmeal. It is accompanied by a number of sauces and fits into the continent-wide paradigm of a mash over which a soupy stew is served. Then there is Xhosa Kramelpap, which is a crumbled porridge. A similar dish goes by the name of Nkosho in the Transkei and is called Putupap in Lesotho. Both all are served with fresh or sour milk and are considered a delicacy. When vegetables are used, cabbage and spinach, turnips and turnip tops are favorites. Sounded like home and greens to me. Meat is something that men eat more than women, although there's an increasing number of lady butchers in the townships because it is a field open to them. Nomzamo prided herself on her innovations. In fact, she has introduced smoked pork to her community, made her a star in my book. She's particularly interested in my questions about gender-specific foods. Certainly in her South African experience, there were things that women could cook and eat, and things that they could cook but not eat, and things that they didn't cook but did eat. Traditionally, she informed me, men are meant to hunt, so they're meant to eat a lot of meat. Women have taken a taste for meat as well, and I would find that out in later days when a visit to a bookstore revealed a book of traditional tales with the title, Women Like Meat. By the end of our conversation, though, night was falling. The lights in the houses were giving off a pale yellow glow, and a chill wind was beginning to whistle through the now abandoned streets of Guguletu. We drove off, with Nomzamo standing in the door of her shop. The butcher of Guguletu was waving, her blue fleece jacket, the lone spot of cheer in the deserted streets.
Brothers and sisters, don't drink and drive, we still need you. Brothers and sisters, don't drink and drive, we still need you.
Hurry up, said Janet, my guide. These folks are major Afrikaners and don't appreciate lateness. Well, I knew of the wines of South Africa, but I was going to be treated to a wine tasting and luncheon at the site of the world-famous Niederburg wine auction. The building itself was impressive, set atop a knoll where iris and daffodils were showing their first blooms, signaling the coming of South African spring. The Grand Salon, where I was met by the charming woman who was to be my guide and hostess, was imposing with massive bouquets of flowers and a baronial fireplace. The luncheon was delicious, a mutton pie with fresh vegetables, parsnips, string beans, carrots, and new potatoes, and the South African version of candied sweet potatoes, prepared with boniato and brown sugar, seasoned with cinnamon sticks, allspice, and nutmeg, the cinnamon that is part of the Cape Malay Holy Trinity of cooking. Following lunch, we adjourned to the wood panel tasting room where the wines were set up. Now, I can fake my way through most wine tastings, but the burgeoning friendship of the morning compelled me to confess that I really am a wine drinker and not a connoisseur. I like my wine red, liquid, and alcoholic. That seemed to endear me to her all the more. You know, she said, I see a lot of experts. It's nice to see someone who wants to know about the wine. Confession made, I proceeded to hunker down to learn about the wines of the region and to exercise my taste buds. Niederburg, my guide explained, is better known for its reds than its white. That was fine with me because I'm a confirmed red wine drinker. And it has 25% of the South African wine market. Then she began by pouring a young Sauvignon Blanc, which we swirled and sniffed and sipped. For the first time, it was not so much blah blah. I could actually taste the slight pétillance and the faint spice of green peppercorns. We moved on through a 96 Chardonnay to the reds that I had been anticipating. While California is known for its varietals and France for its regional styles, the wines of South Africa are named many different ways. At Niederburg, I was taken by a Baronne, a Cabernet Shiraz blend, where the Cabernet provided tastes of black currants and the Shiraz gave a slightly smoky taste. But my favorite of all was the Pinotage. This wine takes its name from the Pinot Noir and Hermitage grapes that are blended together in a uniquely South African fashion. I came to know it all too well during my stay. A young Pinotage is eminently drinkable. With a little age, it can become soft and enveloping. I tasted wines in other parts of the wine-growing region around Cape Town, but somehow, the Pinotage always came out as my favorite, and Niederburg came out as my favorite place. When it came time to leave, among the rest of the stuff that I hauled home was a case of wine, Pinotage, and a couple of bottles of Groot Constantia. What can I do, my baby? I want to make you mine. Naguranza, 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 my baby. Yo, Makesane, Naguranza, my baby. My days in Cape Town continued. I journeyed to Francis Hawk and met Margot Jantz, a woman chef who is noted for cooking fresh, regional, and seasonal in extraordinary ways. I learned from her that ostrich liver is like calf's liver. Slice it thinly and pan fry it. It was delicious. I also had a seared salmon trout that was served on a brioche with a ginger sabayon. And it was served with fried seaweed. Unbelievable. She'd wanted to be an actress, but I'm personally really happy that she went into cooking. Then it was back to Cape Town for the last few days. I walked up and down the streets, visited antique shops on Church Street, found an antique jewelry shop. Knowing me, definitely found a bookstore or two. And soon, all too soon, it was time to head back home. I girded my loins, packed my two suitcases and excess baggage of a case of wine, and headed to the airport. Again, the flight was incredible, and by the time we got up to Isla del Sal, I recognized the names on the map. Abidjan, Dakar, and back into air that I knew. Soon, all too soon, Cape Town was a memory, and I was headed home to dream of going back to Cape Town again and again. Nkosi sikeleli Afrika, maluphakanyisa uthumbo layo, izwa imithandazo yetu. Nkosi sikelela thina lusapho lwayo. But until I get back there, and until next time,
keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone.